And now it's back to Thursday at 8 with your host, Donna Awatere Huata, right here on Radio Waitea.
We in Māoridom achieved something really unique this year. We actually got a win, and it was a win that is going to provide Māoridom with the opportunity of participating in a $16 billion windfall to us, provided we can get all the settings right. And leading that the charge on this was my next guest, Chris Inslee, along with Sir Toby Curtis. So welcome to the show, Chris.
Oh, kia ora, Donna, and kia ora to all of our listeners.
Chris, look, just a little bit of background, because I'm going to be coming back to this topic of the opportunity for Māori and carbon forestry over the next few months as we head into the next election, because it is, you know, it has been quite a dramatic year in the sense that the opportunity was there for Māoridom, and then the threat of taking it away from us came up with the threat to remove permanent forestry from the ETS, and thus a $16 billion opportunity for Māori landowners was just slipping through our fingers. Now, you led that with Sir Toby Curtis, and I'm going to get onto that in a minute, but I wonder if I might, just introduce you to those of our listeners who don't know you. You've worked alongside, I know, for many, many years, you had a very close working relationship with our uncle, Uncle Api. And I just wonder if you could just tell us about some of the events that led up to you working with our rangatira.
Yeah, ka pai, and thank you, Donna. The context that I'd set out is that so I've spent a lot of time working in forestry domestically here in New Zealand, and leadership roles in forestry in New Zealand and in the world. I spent a bunch of years time working in the US for some of the biggest forestry companies in the world. And when I came home, I came back to work with Fletcher Challenge, and at that point, you get the phone call to come home, and so I came back to the coast to Ngāti Porou Forest, and I spent a bunch of time there, working, developing Māori land, Ngāti Porou land, and putting those into forest into a commercial joint venture with Hansol out of South Korea. And it was around about that time that the sort of the awareness in the world of climate change was starting to trigger. And certainly our work back then on the coast, we always held a view very early on, actually, that as the climate changed, and anybody that was involved in forestry, certainly Māori, should take an interest in terms of what was going on in terms of policy development. And so that really led on to a period of time where I can recall about 20 years ago myself, and there wasn't many of us, and the likes of Paul Morgan, who was heading FOMA at the time, where we found ourselves talking with the first government minister of climate change, Labor Minister Pete Hodgson. Mm-hmm. And that was when government was starting to formulate its thinking in those very, very early stages that the threat of climate change was looming, and started to, you know, promote what government might do in terms of policy. And you know, and I recall this vividly, Donna, that the government started to promote, you know, that they would simply nationalise the whole system, meaning that they would take all of the obligations, the international obligations, but would also start to nationalise any kind of benefit. And I remember those discussions very vividly, Paul and I had, where, you know, we were left sitting there thinking and saying, well, Tai Hua, Minister, you can't just say that, because we as Māori, we actually own a lot of forests. And for anyone government or whoever to start to suggest that they were going to nationalise something that, you know, was fundamentally developed by Māori, for Māori on Māori land, well, there was going to be an issue. We wouldn't sit back and just let that happen. So this goes back 20 years ago that we were having this discussion. And then soon after that, to get to your point, with Uncle Uppy, because as we come forward through time and different governments started to think about climate change as a real issue and started to think about different policy settings and options like carbon taxes, even there was at one point there was discussion and talk about a fart tax, and there were other instruments that were starting to be, yeah, you know, that's what it was called back then. That's what governments were actually calling it. And then it was around that time that through Uncle Uppy, who was the chair of iwi leaders leading on behalf of Māori, all of the climate change thinking. So it became involved working very closely with Uncle Uppy and with the likes of Timmy Kehuhu, now passed, but there were others. And as you point to quite rightly, Dora, our late rangatira, Sir Toby, they were all those rangatira back then alongside Uncle Uppy that were leading this, you know, this discussion with government and promoting that, you know, the same thing through the last 20 years, Taihua government, you cannot just do this, anything you're going to do here, without thinking about and talking to us as Māori, you know, not just because of the treaty, but because we were actively involved in land development, forestry, that we had to be part of that discussion. So it was the kind of journey, Donna, you know, that we've been on, and then coming right forward to today, earlier this year, our current government started to promote their thinking around forestry and climate change. And as you point out in your opening, that the proposal at the start of the year was to eliminate fast-growing exotics as an option, inside the ETS and in the permanent forest category. And it was really about that time early this year I started to get phone calls from our people around the country, because they'd all known, you know, we all know each other, everyone that's involved in forestry. They knew of the work that I'd done with Uncle Uppy and them. So I started to get all these phone calls, everybody ringing me and saying, Ehwa, we can't just sit back and let this stuff happen that's been going on for so long. We've done it before in the past, but we won't. So, you know, and I know all of those. They are our rangatira that lead a lot of our forestry lands around the country, and all of them were ringing me. So I got on the phone and I rang our rangatira, Sir Toby, and I said, "E te papa, you champion, you lead this for us. I will bring our people together and we will put our rōpū together to actually, you know, to challenge what government we're promoting." And so that's what really the journey, Donna, and I'd really sum it up by saying that the take that we are promoting today is exactly what we were, the likes of Paul Morgan and I and a few others 20 years ago, we were promoting back then, that Māori are a huge player, are an important player, but today we won't sit back and just allow policy development that eliminates the opportunity, which is what was promoted earlier this year, for our landowners to plant fast-growing exotics. Because here's the key point, Donna, that especially on our marginal Māori lands, there isn't any other option for development. On our steeper country, our marginal land, our erosion-prone land, there isn't. So government proposal to remove fast-growing exotics, that's where the $16 billion number comes from. You know, it's a massive impact for our people, and I come back to all of the ones that rang me and said, we just cannot drop the ball on this. So that's what brings us to where we are today, Donna.
Yeah, no. I'm going to delve into that a little bit deeper because, you know, one of the reasons I took up the show, Chris, was that it's just in response to my own frustration at the fact that we're not being listened to on some of these issues that, you know, in this day and age, you think that we will have moved forward. But, Chris, I'd just like to take you back to those earlier days because the thing that always puzzled me, I wasn't involved at the time, but there were two things that happened that I wonder if you can help explain for us. The first was, why were the pre-1989 forests excluded from the ETS when, you know, that is the forest that we own? You know, most of our forests are, most of our land is pre-1989 forest. It's growing something and it's sequestering carbon, but why aren't we part of the ETS? Why has that been excluded?
Yeah.
And are there any moves to do something about it? What was the quarterly back in those days?
Look, it was quite simple, actually, Donna, that, you know, they had to draw a line in the sand at which, where things were in and where they were out. And that's where the, and the line in the sand was the was 1990. And so anything before or after it, that's how it became classified as pre-1990 or post-1989. It was just an arbitrary decision. There was no real logical science behind it. So there is, there always has been, you know, a challenge for, you know, to try and address that. And I'll tell you the other thing that kind of got left out of this discussion, that with Uncle Uppy and others, that we were always championing, and we still are today, because the other, if you like, parcel that got left out of this discussion was the indigenous forest. And so there too is another, if you like, outstanding issue, because as Maori after government, we are the biggest owner of indigenous forests. And yet they're not recognized for the contribution that those forests make, in not just in carbon sequestration, but in a whole lot of other ways. So, you know, there were just some arbitrary decisions that were made.
You know, the thing that interests me about this is that our indigenous forests are actually included in our reporting to the United Nations. So while we don't get paid anything for sequestration that comes off our land, nevertheless, the government is claiming that as part of its, you know, national targets. And I think that is such a hypocritical thing to do. If you're going to actually cite to the United Nations about how much sequestration you've got, then it shouldn't be just those who planted after 1990 that get, you know, financially rewarded from that. It should be those who are contributing to that claim that's going forward to the United Nations. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, exactly. I just agree. And so in the most recent discussions that we've had with ministers, including Minister James Shaw, we put that to him in our meeting, that the government had to address that and how we include the indigenous forest. And we got an undertaking, so that was partly why we came away from feeling somewhat encouraged back in about May of this year, May, June, when we met with the ministers and where they made the initial commitment to walk back on the excluding of the permanent forest. But they also, Minister James Shaw, gave a commitment that there was work underway to properly recognise indigenous forests, not just for sequestration, but for all of the other things that those forests do, like biodiversity, you know, water capture and storage. There's a whole lot of attributes around our indigenous forests. So we, you know, again, it's another reason we were somewhat encouraged from the meetings that we had with Minister James Shaw and others in about June of this year.
Yeah, no. Chris, look, the other thing that bothered me, although I didn't hear about it, you know, until recently, was when National became the government and Tim Grosser became the minister and allowed the emitters or the polluters to buy credits, carbon credits overseas. What was your role in that? Because I understand that you and Uncle Uppy put together a paper that kind of outlined the impacts of that policy on our people. And what was the minister's response?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We were intimately involved in that whole discussion with Minister Grosser and the Prime Minister of the day, John Key, and others. I recall, you know, what was being contemplated at the time was, so here's sort of part of the context, that there were a number of iwi that were going through settlement negotiations with government at the time. And so, and particularly those in and around the Central North Island. And part of those negotiations was a decision by government as part of their settlement that there would be an allocation of these, what then became the NZUs or the carbon credits, we call them, or whatever we call them today, that the iwi would receive an allocation of those NZUs as part of their settlement. And through those negotiations, it was assumed that they would have a value of $25 per NZU. And and so those settlements took place. The NZUs were transferred and accepted in good faith as part of the settlement that was happening at the time. And so iwi, therefore, that received those settlements had a strong interest in ensuring that the carbon price didn't fall below that $25, and if it did, it would erode the value of those settlements. And as the discussions were playing out at the time around how the government would roll out the emission trading system, there was pressure being brought onto the government of the day by the farmers on the obligation. So it's the same argument that's happening today. The obligations that the farming community would have to meet in terms of their own emissions from farms. And so the farming lobby, it ended up the farming lobby talking to the ministers of the day, Tim Grosser, and Māori on the other hand saying, oh, you better not do anything that undermines the values of our settlements. I recall very, very vividly a big hui that we had in Wellington at the then Duxton Hotel. There would have been 50 to 60 of our Māori forestry iwi leaders that met with Tim Grosser in that meeting and laid out, because the government was one of the options that the government was contemplating doing because of the pressure from the farming community, was to open up the emissions trading system to use to allow emitters to buy cheap international units and use those to surrender into the emissions trading system to meet their emissions obligations. Now, so that was definitely part of the policy thinking at the time. In the meeting at the Duxton Hotel, and iwi, through Uncle Uppy, put out there, well, no, Minister, you cannot do that, because that would directly undermine the value of the settlements, because by allowing the doors to open and allow those cheap international units to be used, it would flood the emissions trading system. So it would create an oversupply, and that would drive down the price. And therefore, that would directly impact the settlement that Māori had received. Now, in that meeting, I do remember it vividly, Minister Tim Grosser stood up and said, no, we hear you. We will never allow that to happen. Literally within a matter of days of that commitment, after we all walked away thinking, oh, well, kei te pai, that's all good to know, the settlement valuations are safe and secure. Within a matter of days of that meeting, the government did a 180-degree turn and allowed those cheap international units into the emissions trading system, and literally overnight, the price collapsed. And who got burned? It was Māori that got burned. It was the recipients who owned all of those units that got burned to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. Now, so in our recent discussion, Donna, with Minister James Shaw and Minister Nash and other ministers, we pointed to that fact that we had been in the same position that we find ourselves today, and Māori got burned. And so that we have never forgotten that. We were given an undertaking, and then government walked away from it, deliberately, yep. knowingly, the impact it would have.
Yeah. Chris, the figure I remember, because I read the paper, and the figure that's, it stuck in my brain all these, ever since, was $600 million was going to be wiped off the Māori estate if they continued to allow those cheap credits to be bought by emitters. You know, was that a close approximation of what Māoridom lost?
Yeah, it is. If you take into account not just the direct value that was lost by Māori in terms of the collapse of the price, there's also the lost opportunity that Māori had. If had that value not been destroyed, Māori could have reinvested the valuation into other activity through time and grown that. So the number is a big number.
Yeah, it's huge. Look, Chris, I wonder if I could now just leapfrog forward to today. Now, I was at both those hui that we had with the ministers, and, you know, thanks to Sir Toby's mana, we had, I think it was 6 or 7 ministers in both of the hui. We had one in June and one in July. And one of the things that I came away from that was that the ministers agreed to set up a governance group, which was led by Te Taumata with yourself as chair, and then to set up a co-designing technical advisory group, and we were to put in our nominations of who they were, and they would be our forestry experts, and then they would work alongside the Crown. And the objective was to debunk a lot of the myths, almost lies, that have been put out there by, you know, those whose interest it is, and that is really the farming lobby, about, you know, there's too many trees and you can grow natives without any forestry cover, all of this stuff. I'm just wondering what happened to both the undertakings. Firstly, the removal of permanence from the ETF category, and secondly, the commitment from the ministers to set up that technical advisory group.
Yeah, look. Can I just start by saying, who was at the meeting? So you're right, it was Sir Toby that convened the meeting with the ministers. Originally, that meeting was proposed that we had that Sir Toby had sent an invitation to the Prime Minister, Minister James Shaw, and Minister Stuart Nash to convene a national hui in Rotorua to bring all of our people together with the Prime Minister and these two key ministers to have that discussion. Now, that invitation was declined, later there was a call from Minister Nash and James Shaw that instead we had to travel to Wellington. So, who was at the meeting? I think it's important for everybody to know who was at the meeting. At the meeting were Māori forestry landowners from across the country. So they weren't just people that, you know, Māori that had an interest, or they might have been, you know, they were Māori that actually sat on trusts appointed by their people to administer their forests from across the country. So we had representatives from Ngāpuhi te Taitokarau. We had representatives from Te Whānau Wapanui Whakatoa Hea Ngāti Porau Te Aitanga Mahaki, from Te Arawa, from Ngāti Tū Whare Toa, from the South Island, Ngāti Rārua. Everybody was at that hui. It's important to make that point. It was our Māori forestry people that are directly affected by these policy proposals. So that's right. As we were having the discussion, I have to say, it was, in my view, it was everybody's mana was respected. I think it was a deeply respectful hui that we had together. There was nobody talking over the top of each other. you know, certainly from our side, we welcomed the discussion with the ministers, and they reciprocated. You know, it was frank discussion, but it was respectful. As we were going through the discussion, Minister Stuart Nash, you know, he could see the tension that, you know, and he could hear it directly from our Māori forestry landowner rangatira, that everybody was upset at the proposal that he had to remove the fast-growing exotics. So you'll recall, as we went through the discussion, he made the comment. He says, look, I'm pretty sure that we're aiming at the same thing. You know, we're trying to achieve the same outcome, and that is that in the long term, we're all, us as Māori included, we are absolutely committed to planting and developing indigenous forestry across our land. There was no question about that. He put that up. He says, if we're agreed in the long term that we have a shared view, and we confirmed that we did, and then he said, you know, I think there's a win-win here. And that is, so how do we plant in the short term the fast-growing exotics, so that wouldn't deny the development opportunity to our Māori landowners, which was the issue that we were promoting. We did not want the government to legislate that option away. So he put that, he said, I think there is a win-win here. And we had all of our technical team there, and we had a very strong technical team in that corridor. And he said, what I think we need to be doing is to figure out how do we do both. How do we plant fast-growing exotics in the short term, but through time, that the indigenous forest would come away as a secondary understory crop, and then maybe over the next 50, 100 years, we would get to where we agreed was a shared objective. And you'll recall that we all looked at each other, our technical teams and everyone said, we agree. We agree that's a valid thing, and that's right. We said, let's do it. And then and at that point, I remember vividly, Sir Toby tapped me on the shoulder and he said...
I was sitting next to him, Chris. I saw it.
I know. He whispered to me, he says, Chris, tell them we put our technical teams together to work it all out. You know, this is exactly what happened. And I said, ministers, Sir Toby has just put forward a suggestion that we think is a valid way to move this corridor forward, and that we put together our technical teams and alongside your technical teams, and they sit together and they figure out how to do the work, what's the science, the modelling work that needs to do to come up with the forest management regime. And the ministers agreed. The ministers agreed. And so we all sat there and said, oh, well, and we came away from that hui feeling
exhilarated.
Great.
We
thought, and you'll recall in that discussion, you'll recall in that discussion, Donna, that because I did ask, just to be clear, of Minister Nash, I said, so, Minister Nash, if we agree that putting our technical teams together, we can come up with a forest management regime that will be a win-win for both. And he says yes. And I said, so let me be clear. So let me be very clear that, therefore, if we can demonstrate that this is correct and we can prove through the technical work, you are pulling back on your decision to remove the fast-growing exotics as an option. And he said yes. And that was really where we felt, oh wow, we've made some inroads. You know, so we came away feeling genuinely encouraged. You know, and I remember
I think our hui actually shifted the minister, because he gave a speech to the I can't remember, it's kind of a native forestry conference, some huge event, and he actually said, look, this is the way to go. It's called transitional forestry. Plant your exotics, get the incomes in that allows you to, you know, do native planting, because it's very expensive, and you know, you've got to do pest management, you've got to fence it off. You've got a lot, you know, it creates jobs, but it is expensive and you can actually pay for it. So it was definitely a win-win. And I just thought if nothing came out of that, then, you know, that was just a brilliant outcome on top of the removal of the, keeping the permits in the ETS.
Yeah. So your question was, so what happened to the technical working group? So after the meeting, within a matter of days, we put together our technical team, and can I say it was and still is a very, very strong technical team.
Yes.
We put up the Kapunga Jews. The Kapunga has got a lot of time in leadership roles. He's a graduate of the Canterbury School of Forestry. He has a master's degree. He's been involved in a whole lot of forest development. Led major, been held senior management roles in big forestry companies. And so we put up the Kapunga Jews to lead the technical team, and we wrapped around him a lot of other Maori technical forestry experts. We had a very, very strong team, and we promoted that back within a matter of days, along with our governance team, back to the ministers and said, Anate, here's our team, please nominate your team to work alongside our team, and then let's set them to work. So we put that team to government within a matter of days, and sadly, Donna, this is where it all started to go wrong. That it took months and months to get a response from government. And seriously, to get, you know, a simple response and saying, well, here's their team. So it took us days, but it took them months, probably about 3 or 4 months before we started to get some feedback, and said, and the feedback kind of went like this. We've been putting our technical team together, but now we realize on our technical team, this is actually what Minister Nash said to me. He said, we're up to about 12 on our side. And I'm going, hicka, 12, to do quite a simple piece of work. You know, we'd nominated 3 or 4, like we thought was appropriate. But this is where it started to go wrong. They had 12, and there had to be, you know, people representing all of the different stakeholding groups in this group. And we started to say, well, gee, you know, we only need a, you know, handful of technical people to do this work. But it kind of exploded out, you know, it got out of control, naming all of these different people. And it got to a point where we said, went back to the minister and said, look, at the end of the day, minister, we don't care who you have on your team. We actually don't care how many people you have on your team. That's really for you to manage on your side. Just name your team. The only thing that we were absolutely adamant about was that the Kapunga Jews would chair that working group. That technical working group, and the minister agreed. He agreed to that, and we thought, well, okay, we're getting somewhere, but it's going to be a bloody long-winded process with probably a lot more people than necessary to do a simple piece of work. And so we agreed to that, but there was one final thing that we agreed to together with the minister, and that was we had to agree the terms of reference for the group, because then through the officials, it started through some of the releases by Minister James Shaw that they were going to encumber that process by getting that working group to look at a whole lot of other sort of semi-unrelated issues. And so at that point we said, no, we need to agree the terms of reference. And that's where it really fell apart. We were sent a terms of reference. That was really fait accompli. We never had an opportunity to contribute to actually what the group would work to. It was given to us with a direction, sign this. Just sign it. And so we refused. Just on the basic principle, on a number of principles, but one of them, just the basic principle, we never had a chance to actually sit down and discuss and agree, as we agreed to do when we had the hui with Sir Toby. So we said no. We need to actually sit together and agree what the work is going to is involved. And it got to a point where ministers started to get a bit, angry, anxious, and said, "Oh well, send us what you guys think," which we did within a matter of days. We sent a proposal back and said, "Here's what we think is an appropriate terms of reference. Can we agree this? And let's start the work tomorrow." And at that point, which was about a month or so ago, all the discussions stopped, and then we were basically heard through the media that government had decided to go it alone and do that technical work on that forest management transition regime without us. Without us.
But you know, but you know, Chris, what was so exciting about it was an acceptance by the ministers. And just to remind let our viewers in on what happened, a number of the Labor ministers came along. You know, there was the Minister Willie Jackson, Nanaia Mahuta, Emeka, Kiritapu Allen, you know, a whole bunch of them, and other the Māori caucus and the Māori ministers really stepped up to support us. And there was this agreement. And so part of you know, actually part of me taking up this program to do it has been because I've decided to shine a light on some of the undertakings that have been, you know, made recently that have been reneged on in contradiction to the acts of Parliament that that Labor have passed, like the Public Service Act, which says they must give effect to the Treaty of Waitangi, and they're actually not doing it. And this action by the Crown of making a high-handed decision to just run the you know, to do the whole of the technical stuff themselves, appoint their own people who they want, it is such a breach of the spirit of the treaty. It is a breach of the principles of the treaty. So, you know, we're I think we're just in a situation now, Chris, where, you know, we may have to look at things like the Waitangi Tribunal. I know you have raised the issue of an injunction earlier on, but this cannot go unchallenged. And, you know, while our listeners are saying, I wonder why they're making such a big deal about this forestry matter, the fact is we're talking about a $16 billion opportunity for rural land that is marginal. It's doing nothing much at the moment, no return. It's very difficult. You can't farm it. And so here's the opportunity of a lifetime for our whānau in the rural areas to get jobs and to get some really quite massive incomes coming in. You know, so
yeah, well,
it's this is a big matter for us. It's huge.
This is it, Donna. There's a few things that I weave into there as well. You're right. So that's the economic loss to our regions. And I make the point again that for our marginal Māori lands that are steep, that are erosion prone, etc., there's no other option. There's no other option for these lands. So this is why it's such a big issue. But the other point of it is that we're very clear that it would also, by allowing the development to occur on these lands, it will create tens of thousands of new jobs in our community. And we've seen practical examples of this happen where forestry, like in Northland with the Taitokaro forests and the Opodi forest, etc., the creation of that forest up there on those sands along the 90 mile beach, that land was otherwise worthless, but by planting through government, planting forests on there, it really, really created a whole new industry, especially for our people, you know, in rural places like that. But it's the same on the East Coast. The same thing has happened with the planting of those forests. So we know there's no other opportunity for this class of land, and we know that we know how to grow these forests, and they grow really, really well. And then you get all the other benefits of the sequestering of carbon. And if you can do it in a way that transitions to indigenous forest in time, it's such a win-win. So, you create a lot of jobs. Here's the other part of it, though, Donna, that I think everybody should understand. By planting these forests, New Zealand, all planting of all of these forests will meet all of New Zealand's international emissions reduction obligations that Minister James Shaw has been talking about at the last two COP meetings. By upping New Zealand's ambition to reduce emissions, planting these forests will actually enable New Zealand, not just Māori, to meet all of its international obligations and not have to spend billions of dollars buying up international billions of dollars of taxpayers' money to buy up international offsets. So, you know, we see on the news every day, and we see it tonight with the whole discussion about the increases with the Reserve Bank increasing the official cash rate, that one of the biggest issues that we're facing as a nation is the rising cost of living. Well, I just sit back and I really struggle. I really struggle. Why would we spend billions of dollars of taxpayers' money when things are so tough here at home, to buy up these international offsets when we don't have to? When there's a solution sitting right in front of us all, and yet government is looking straight past it. I just don't get it.
Absolutely. I tell you, Chris, there was a research piece of research done by a company, Infometrics, which showed that the cost to taxpayers will be at least $30 billion. $30 billion. I mean, how many houses is that? You know, how much investment in our new wood pulp, our wood post, wood industries is that? Or, you know, we need to get energy infrastructure going. $30 billion, we're going to spend it overseas when we could actually help Māori earn $16 billion at least and create all of this wealth in our rural community. It just doesn't make sense. Chris, look, I'm sorry about this, but we've run out of time. But, Chris, thank you for coming on. I wanted to introduce you to our listeners because I want this to be an ongoing conversation, because, honestly, I have written to James Shaw, to Dr. Rod Carr, and to James Shaw to say, if you guys have got a better idea for our marginal lands, you know, if you've got some bright idea how we can make this kind of money off our rural marginal lands, then I'd like to hear it. But there's nothing. Mm. That's why this is so important, and why, Chris, we've got to continue to fight for it. So I just leave it there. But, Chris, would you like to just have a final word? Chris, just one other thing. Next week on our program, we're devoting it to a tribute to Sir Toby Curtis's legacy. You know, you and I know how big that was, and I'm hoping you might come back and share a few of your experiences with our chief next Thursday night. But any final thoughts, Chris?
Yeah, look, the final thoughts that I'd make is, so given the government's decision to progress with their own working group, so collectively what we've decided to do, this is all of our Māori forestry leaders and our governance team and our technical team. We're putting together our own technical team right now, led by Te Kapunga Dews. It'll be a world-class team of technicians to do this piece of work that we had intended doing alongside government, but we're going to do it ourselves. And the point I'd really like to make here tonight to your listeners, Donna, and that is that our people have agreed to fund it. Our Māori forestry landowners have agreed to fund this work ourselves. Now, you know, so this is not Māori just looking for handouts. We're prepared to pay the cost of doing this work ourselves. So I've been confirming with Te Kapunga now. We're ready to get him started to do the technical work. And when the time is right early in the new year, we will release our own. It will be high quality piece of analysis as part of the ongoing discussion with government. And my final word is, from all of our people that I've been talking to about this issue over the last few days, everyone has been saying to me, "Ke kaha tātou, we will not drop the ball on this." That's my last word for tonight, Donna. Kia ora, and thank you to our listeners.
Kia ora, Chris. Oh my goodness, what a way to end our program. You know, I think what Chris has done tonight is shine a light on some of the, you know, negotiations and harassments that we go through in trying to get a better deal for our people with ministers. You know, I've spent the last 5 years in and out of ministers' offices, and you go through this, you know, you win some, you lose some, but, you know, with Chris's help and led by our own very own Sir Toby Curtis, we had a huge win earlier this year, and the fight continues. So kia ora tātou, everyone.